This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, a new controversy over Walmart's employment practices and journalist Bob Woodward's new book, State of Denial, causes an uproar in the nation's capital. Joining us today to discuss these topics and more from our Washington headquarters, economist and author Julianne Malveaux, president and CEO of Last Word Productions. And in our New York bureau, Bob Meadows, writer for People magazine, and Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. Welcome to all of you. And let's start with Walmart. A new report in the New York Times said that it wants to cap wages, use more part-time workers, schedule more workers on nights and weekends, give workers less of a say on when they can work, ultimately growing its part-time workforce to 40%. Walmart responded to the report in a statement we received late yesterday, and that read in part, "A small number of our associates, only 3%, are at or above the maximum pay range, and no associates' pay will be reduced. We created more than 240,000 jobs over a three-year period. The majority of our associates are full-time, mid to low 70%. So, Julianne, let me start with you. The basic controversy here is whether or not Walmart is, in essence, trying to lower its employment cost by putting more people on a part-time schedule and putting wage caps. Should this even be a big issue, or is this just business as usual?
Well, it absolutely should be a big issue for Rye. It's been the issue of legislation, not regarding Walmart, but in general, during this Republican administration. You've got two competing issues here. One is the issue of employer flexibility, the question of whether or not you can have workers work at any time. And the other is the issue of worker rights. How can people schedule their child care, their doctor's appointments, their worship services? What kind of rights do they have in a sort of an at-will, free-flow labor market? We had a piece of legislation that came up in about 2002, the Worker Flexibility Act, that would have allowed people or allowed employers to schedule people any 80 hours over a two-week period before they paid overtime. In other words, as opposed to having a 40-hour week, you have an 80-hour sort of free-floating at employer convenience 2 weeks. That legislation has not passed. This Walmart policy, if it is indeed a policy, seems a way to get around that and essentially to disempower workers. So we should be very concerned, and there is the possibility of legislation to contain this kind of activity. And I hear Michael Myers clearing his throat.
You're right.
Go ahead, Michael.
Look, I do not have any stock in Walmart, and excuse the pun, but look, department stores, like any other business, should pay prevailing wages, and they should accord full-time workers health benefits. And as well, there is an overlay of unionization and wage and hour laws and anti-discrimination laws, including age discrimination laws. I believe in all those laws, and I believe in a prevailing wage. But also, department stores in particular need a flexible workforce. It's not one way. It's two ways. They need to hire seasonal and part-time workers. Now, these are business decisions. Now, just like there are workers' rights, there are managerial management rights as well. So I'm not going to be one to pile on Walmart, because I know this is a pile on Walmart season, particularly as the holiday season comes up. And although Andy Young has lost his position, I know he gave it his best shot. He messed up. They need a spokesman. Call me.
Well, we should say that Walmart is one of NPR's underwriters, but I'm going to go to you, Bob. I mean, it seems to me that one of the more contentious aspects of this is some workers alleging that they are being forced out, that their wages are already at or above this cap, and so they're never going to get a raise. Walmart says, on the other hand, this will urge them to seek higher levels of employment. But if you find yourself in a position where you can't go up any further or you don't necessarily have the skills to go up any further, that just means you won't get a pay raise ever.
Which is just a terrible thing. I really enjoy my job, but if I never got a pay raise, that would, can you imagine the morale of that? That just tears you down so much.
You could get a promotion, though.
You could get a promotion. You're absolutely right. Thank you. Thank you very much for that,
you're
Mike.
You're very welcome.
The thing is,
I'm speaking for Walmart.
You're right.
He's trying to get one, so, you know, why not everybody else?
You know, you know, I'll tell you this, Farai, though. One of the reason Walmart can get away with this, which, yeah, this is a business. They have to make as much money, and I'm all for that, making as much money as you can. But you have to take into account your workers. But the reason, of course, they can get away with this is because consumers don't care. Consumers love Walmart. I was in Louisiana over the weekend. Walmart was the place to be because they have all these great savings. And even people who will say, yeah, I don't really like it, but they find themselves there. Obviously, here in New York, since we don't have them, it's not much of an issue. But yeah, absolutely. When you get to these small towns, and the other part of it, Walmart has said that they're going to make this commitment to come into more urban areas, which I'm still waiting to see when that happens.
Well, actually, there's been some controversy over that. I mean, in Los Angeles, there was actually quite a bit of resistance to Walmart coming in, so it's not necessarily a one-way street. Anyway, Julianne?
Let me just jump in a quick minute for Rye. A couple things. To Michael's point, they have a right to flexibility, but why not give people evening schedules then? I mean, you could have someone who's full-time and who works from, you know, 3 to 10 as opposed to from, you know, 9 to 5 if that's the problem. The fact is that they're trying to cut their costs. It's a national movement
to
try
to
cut costs.
Isn't every business trying to cut its costs?
Just a moment, Michael. And the reason why consumers, Bob, don't care, it's not so much that they don't care. They're getting good deals. Walmart is the biggest thing in town. They are getting scale economies when they buy all over the country. They have stuff that's being made specifically for them that you can't get anywhere else. So you've got, you know, working moms who need diapers, and they're getting them 20% cheaper at Walmart than they are somewhere else. So they're not going to care about, you know, next door neighbor's wage when they're confronted with basically a savings of their own. The issue is that workers should have some rights, and it seems to me, and I haven't seen their response, but it seems to me that this company systematically seems to downgrade workers' rights. The wage cap is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard
and
of.
And I say... that.
And you say you want a job.
No,
you already put yourself
out there.
Brother, you have no more credibility.
All right, folks. All right. Well, before we go back to Michael. No, we're going to get to you, Bob. But Michael, let me throw this at you. Walmart says that they're doing what Sears and Target already do. So is this simply... you know, is Walmart the one, the company that has to wear the flak jacket because everything that goes on in retailing sort of ends up being blamed on them?
As I said, this is power on Walmart season. Everybody powers on Walmart. It's a business. I don't know any business that doesn't want to cut its costs. And cost cutting is part of business. If you excuse me, Julia.
Okay, folks.
I said that I agree with labor laws. I agree with wage and hour laws. I agree with anti-discrimination laws and anti-age discrimination laws. But I also believe that businesses don't need an economic czar, particularly Julianne Malvo, looking over their shoulders,
they
telling them every
spokesman.
Decision they make
I
is anti-worker.
All right, guys, you're getting too much back and forth. We're going to move on to another topic. And Bob, you are going to get to go first.
Yes.
It's about another Bob. Bob Woodward's new book, State of Denial, criticizes the Bush administration's handling of the Iraq War. It claims Laura Bush and former White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card wanted to dump Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary. Woodward also claims that 2 months before 9/11, Condoleezza Rice ignored warnings of al-Qaeda attacks from former CIA Chief George Tenet. Now, in some ways, Bob Woodward's previous book to this was considered favorable to the administration. Mm-hmm. This one is seen as an attack. How important are books like these that have a lot of inside access to our look at the political process?
Well, they're very important because the Bush administration has been so incredibly secretive about what's been going on. They haven't been forthright. Pretty much everything that they've said. Has turned out to not be true, whether it's you know, looking for the weapons of mass destruction, whether it's not the Iraqis are going to welcome us with flowers once Saddam is gone. Oh, by the way, how long this war would last and how much it would cost, too. So, yeah, you need books like this. I'm a little... yeah, you're right. Bob Woodward's first two books about Bush were very favorable. Why is he now? What made him switch? I'd like to know the answer to that. People are, of course, saying, well, it's because the president didn't talk to him for this book. So I really want to know. And I'm also wondering, why was he so late to the party? Everything he's saying has already been put out there in plenty of other books. Why is Bob Woodward so late to this? It's like all of a sudden he's just realized that, oh, by the way, this war isn't really working out.
But Julianne, even though he's late, he is a celebrated author whose books always manage to shake things up, you know. So in a way, whether or not he is late to the party, he is someone whose word is being taken seriously.
Well, this may well be a case of better late than never, especially given his first two books that, as you said, Farai, were favorable. The big news here, there's a lot of stuff that's not news. It was interesting. I watched a Larry King interview last night, and a woman called and said, some of this should have been on the front page of the Washington Post, not buried, you know, in the pages of your book, and I agree with that. So there's a little conflict that I think a lot of people who are journalistic experts have talked about in terms of the roles that he plays. But I think the stuff on Rumsfeld, especially right now heading into an election season, is interesting. Some of it is news. Poor Tony Snow can't spin this if he wants to. I mean, he's trying like heck, but it's just not working. And the fact is that Rumsfeld has been a controversial figure who has not gotten along with the others on the so-called defense team. He and Condoleezza Rice clearly have been at you know, loggerheads for quite some time. He apparently, and you've seen this in the body language, and now it's confirmed, does not respect her, did not return her calls. So some of this is news. It gives us a sense of an administration in disarray, while now more than 3,000 Americans are dead.
Michael, I think that what Julianne mentioned was actually what I was most struck by, the allegation that Rumsfeld doesn't really talk to Rice. Most people know that the former Secretary of State, Colin Powell, was frozen out. But Rice seems to be very much in the loop. How do you parse out that situation between the Defense Secretary and the Secretary of State?
Oh, I watched the Larry King interview as well. What is it? Bob Woodward now is a gossip columnist? This obsession with calling for Rumsfeld's resignation, it is, to use a ex-Congressman Mark Foley word, childish. Childish. Rumsfeld is doing George W. Bush's bidding. Bush has reiterated his confidence in Rumsfeld. The man is not going to resign. Now, look, as far as Tony Snow is concerned, I agree with Tony Snow. We've read this book before. By the way, I love the fact that we have a White House spokesperson now who doesn't even sound robotic. He can actually think and say what he wants to say. But the Bob Woodward book, this last one, you know, it's All the President's Men Again, Part 2. There's no crimes here, however, except for war crimes and the like. And that's George Bush's situation and not just his underlings. So I suspect that the question that the American people want to hear is, do we really expect President Bush and his men and women to tell the truth about Iraq or to be in a state of denial? And the answer is, we expect them to be in a state of denial. The title of the book.
All right. Well, we're just going to leave that topic and point out that this is all people's opinion. Moving on to informed opinion, of course. Moving on to black colleges. We've got a couple minutes left.
Is it my turn to go first?
Okay, Michael. I love how everyone now is petitioning to go first.
Oh, you know.
let me get it's kind of a couple of interlocking topics. One, HBCUs in and around Atlanta are pumping millions of dollars, you know, actually $10.8 billion into the state of Georgia. But they're having a harder time drawing students. According to the U.S. Education Department, black students choosing to attend an HBCU fell from 18% in 1976 to just under 13% in 2001. Now, obviously, white schools or predominantly white schools have opened up to black students, but I guess, Michael, is this sort of the death knell for HBCUs, or is this just what we should expect?
There's been a death knell for HBCU schools for a long time. I say, I'm not a religious person, although I am. If there's the death knell, God bless them. Good. Because race and racial loyalty is not what it used to be. We don't need black colleges. We don't need white colleges. That's just old hat. We need a non-racial institutions of higher education. We have to see that the race-identifiable colleges are anachronistic. Of course black students are going to the better schools, to the best schools that they can get into, just like whites, just like Hispanics, just like Asians. Nobody's running to a black school because it's a black school anymore. That's just old-fashioned thinking. This is a marketplace of ideas, and we need critical thinking. We cannot guilt black students into going to black colleges anymore. Period.
We
I say
have
thank
no
God.
Guilt. Michael Myers, shame on you. We should not guilt them.
I have
them.
No shame and no guilt.
I know
guilt.
That. That's very clear. You know, we should not have to guilt them into anything, but we still do need HBCUs. For Rye, if you look at the landscape, obviously Michael is right about one thing. Students should go to the best place they can get into. In some cases, that is an HBCU. If only 18% of our kids are going to college, that means that, you know, there's another 30% who could go. There are kids in community colleges who could be in four-year colleges. The fact is that some of these HBCUs are offering an excellent education, and some of them are also offering a diverse education that includes outreach to Latinos and to whites. And so these schools need to be saved. But here's the deal. The people I have ire with are these HBCU alums that are not giving to their schools. If you look at the records at HBCU alums, you know, what Princeton has a 66% alumni giving rate. Morgan State shows up as NA. In other words, not applicable. In other words, not enough people to count. Now, that's what you call a shame. So if people who are decrying the death of HBCUs are upset about it, they need to give to these schools. The physical plant needs to be improved. You know, Jeanetta Cole has gone to Bennett and doubled their alumni giving rate in a four-year period. But we still need these schools. They are an affordable option for young African-American people. And Michael Myers, just go somewhere.
Okay, you know? Guys, Bob's got the last minute.
Yeah, well, you know, I have to say I actually agree with Julian, but I Googled each of us on this panel, and I know none of us went to HBCUs.
You got that right.
But my cousins did, and my friends did.
Hey, my wife went to an HBCU, and I'm not trashing them. But, you know, I think one of the reasons we have to remember, you know, black men aren't going to college the way they used to. That's one of the things that's a problem. I also think a different world isn't on anymore. That sent a lot of kids to black colleges back in the day. But you're right, exactly right. Where are the black college alum giving back to their schools, supporting their schools so that they're not so run down? Man, I went to Morehouse back in the day and couldn't believe how run down it was. Those dorms were atrocious. Not every school has a Bill Cosby waiting to give them $20 million.
A different world isn't on anymore, but we're living in a different world. Race isn't what it used to be. Goodbye, black colleges. Goodbye, white colleges.
It's still a factor. And you continue to ignore it. It's still a factor.
Okay. On that note, in New York, Bob Meadows from People Magazine, Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, and in Washington, economist Julianne Malveau, president and CEO of Last Word Productions Incorporated.
Thanks
Thank you all for this spirited discussion.